From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Today, the Supreme Court let part of President Trump's travel ban take effect while the court reviews it. We'll start there with NPR's Ron Elving, senior Washington editor and correspondent. Hi, Ron.
Hey, Jeremy.
So parts of the travel ban will go into effect until justices hear arguments in October. This means that refugees and people from six Muslim-majority countries who do not have a personal or business relationship with someone in the U.S. will be banned from entry for 90 days. What are the implications of this?
The implications are great if you don't have any kind of connection into the United States, no anchor, no family member, no scholarship to go to a college or a job that's waiting for you. Now, of course, if you have any of the documents that allow you to travel to the United States, you're fine. So that's quite different from where we were in January, more similar to the revised order in March. But of course, as you know, both of those executive orders had been stayed in the courts. Now we are going to apply them only to those people who have no connection. So a certain class of refugee, a certain class of people coming from these countries is going to be excluded as the president wished. And that is why this is being read as, and certainly being celebrated at the White House as, a partial victory at least for President Trump, even though it could all be reversed in October.
And we'll have to wait and see exactly how people react to this. But we remember the chaos at the airports when the travel ban was rolled out. Do you expect to see that again?
It should not be as bad, but of course, we don't really know. We'll have to see how many people show up without the necessaries. If there are a lot of people who, not knowing or trying to defy this particular travel ban, show up without the necessary connection, show up without the documents to enter the United States, they would be excluded. And so there could be a certain amount of chaos. But it should not be as bad as it was at the January point, where no one really knew who was included and who was excluded.
The Supreme Court also today ruled 7-2 in favor of a Missouri church that wanted state funding for playground improvements. And in a rare move, Justice Sotomayor read her dissenting opinion from the bench. How consequential is this decision?
It's a consequential decision for certain in the sense that the court has generally, and federal courts have generally said, look, let's keep this simple. If you're a church, you're not supposed to be getting taxpayer money. But this is a playground, and it's a safety thing, and it's a state program that's taxpayer supported. And so what happened was that the state said, well, gee, the court in the state of Missouri said, we can't let you give any money to this church, even if it is just to make this playground safer, resurface it, because, you know, you're a church. And that, of course, offended several members of the Supreme Court, seven of them. And Chief Justice Roberts wrote that it was odious to our Constitution to single out a nonprofit and say, you can't have this thing for safety purposes because you are a religious institution. Then they put a footnote on this, and this is very important. They put a footnote on saying, we're only talking about a playground here. We are not talking about instruction. We're not talking about building schools. We're just talking about making a playground safer. This is a very narrow interpretation. But there are those who will see this as the nose of the camel under the tent and an opportunity for a lot more taxpayer dollars to go to parochial schools.
One more item from the Supreme Court before we get to the health care bill in the Senate, and that is that justices agreed to take up a religious liberty case involving a Colorado baker who refused to make a wedding cake for a gay couple. What's at stake there?
We have seen similar cases that have not come this far. The baker in this case said it would violate his principles, his religious rights, his religious liberty, to be forced to participate in any way in a wedding ceremony. In his case, he would be making the cake for a couple that he did not think had a religious right or in his own religious belief could not be allowed to marry. So this is going to test a lot of the different arrangements that are made with respect to gay couples having a marriage or just all kinds of accommodations for LGBTQ people. And it's going to be a really significant case.
All right. Meanwhile, in the Senate, Ron, we just got a new version of the Republican health care bill just posted this afternoon. They're still saying they want to vote on this week. First of all, what's the difference with the new bill and what's happening with this bill?
Most of the changes are technical changes, but there is a new section saying that if you let your health insurance coverage lapse for 63 days, you're going to be locked out of the insurance market for the next 6 months. This, of course, goes back to pre-existing conditions and a lot of the bigger issues in the bill, but they are trying to jimmy the bill just a little bit here and there to bring back on board some of these conservative members. This would be something that could lower premium costs and make life a little easier for insurance companies. Of course, it's not going to make life easier for the people who are affected by it. But right now, the entire purpose of whatever they do in terms of the Senate negotiations is to try to get more of these Republican senators back on board so they can have a vote on Thursday and pass it.
Does it look like that's working?
It looks like if they bring it to the floor, they will not come to the floor until and unless they have 50 votes for it. So no one can guarantee it'll be on the floor on Thursday morning for a vote.
And we remember that in the House bill, it failed the first time, or it didn't get a vote, and then they came back later and were able to pass it through the Republican House. Ron Elving, senior Washington editor and correspondent for NPR, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, now to the tug of war over foreign policy in the Trump administration. A headline in the New York Times today reads, "When Trump zigs, Tillerson zags," referring to Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. The example, Qatar. President Trump sides with Saudi Arabia, calling Qatar a funder of terrorism. Tillerson is calling on the Saudis to make more reasonable demands of the Qataris. Then there's Ukraine, where Russian troops have been backing a separatist movement in the eastern part of the country since 2014, after Russia invaded Ukraine and annexed Crimea. U.S. policy has been to condemn Russia for that. But Patrick Tucker, tech editor for Defense One, writes about a tug of war there. He joins us by Skype. And Patrick, you remind us about that friendly, closed-door meeting President Trump had in May with Russia's foreign minister and ambassador. The New York Times reports Trump expressed frustration to the Russians that his critics were so focused on Ukraine. But you write that Vice President Pence also had a White House meeting at that time with the foreign minister of Ukraine and brought him to Trump.
That same day, Mike Pence takes Pavlo Klimkin into the Oval Office for a photo op. And according to a member of the Ukrainian ministerial staff whom I spoke to, who didn't want to be named, Pavlo Klimkin was actually able to extract a pretty significant promise from Donald Trump, where Donald Trump said that the future peace negotiation was not going to throw Ukraine under the bus.
In other words, the idea of Russia and the U.S. negotiating a peace in Syria wouldn't
right.
impact America's stand against Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But then
right.
The president sent out a tweet seeming to equate Russia and Ukraine.
Right. He did. So this is fascinating because if you look at the readouts from the vice president's office and the president's office, it's sort of night and day. The president sent out a tweet saying that he met with the Russian foreign minister and he met with the Ukrainian foreign minister, and now it was time to make peace. It sounds sort of like a blasé and not particularly provocative statement on its face, but to a lot of people that watch this debate very closely, that sort of sounds like forgiving the Russian intrusion into Ukraine, because to allow the negotiation now to end and for there to be quote-unquote peace, that would mean that the illegal annexation of Crimea becomes the norm. And so a lot of people thought that that was a really strange tweet to send, and it didn't align with either U.S. policy, ally policy, current NATO policy, or really the way anyone in the State Department before January of 2017 thought about this issue.
Well, he used the hashtag, "Let's Make Peace," which implies that it's Ukraine that has to come and sort of make peace with Russia, when in fact, as you said, you're talking about not just the invasion and annexation of Crimea, but the current battle that's going on, in which people are being slaughtered still in eastern Ukraine
right.
with Russian troops involved. Are you saying that perhaps Vice President Pence, along with others, UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, who's had completely different language about Russia and Ukraine, mm-hmm. are you saying that they are trying to maneuver President Trump into a better understanding of Ukraine?
I think that that's a conclusion that you can draw based on statements that they've made publicly. And there's only the question is, how open is he to that pressure? And he seems fairly open to it, but it looks more and more to observers like pressure that's externally applied. and created through exactly these sorts of exchanges, which you can say this was probably a useful exchange to have with the foreign minister of Ukraine on that particular day. And that might have had some impact later on the ability of the Treasury Department now to renew new sanctions.
The Russian broadcaster RT is reporting that the U.S. may begin supplying weapons to Ukraine to help those forces in the East fight those Russian-backed separatists. Your sense of that happening?
It's probably pretty good. This is a really critical moment for the way the West as a unified structure talks about the future of Russian aggression. And on the one hand, you have a really strong consensus that says that the U.S., along with our allies, has to hold Russia accountable for a completely illegal invasion that they've lied about. And the position of Donald Trump himself remains something of a mystery. But there's a strong sense for people that watch this very closely that he's being pulled in the direction of siding with the Western alliance. And sometimes that pull looks like actually pulling the Ukrainian foreign minister into his office for an unscheduled meeting that results in an important promise to an important ally that's under attack.
Despite the tweet that followed.
It's not an even pull. It's a tug of war.
Patrick Tucker, tech editor for Defense One. Patrick, thank you.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Later this week, President Trump will hold a fundraiser for his 2020 reelection campaign, and the high-priced event will be at the Trump International Hotel, blocks from the White House. Ethics experts say that's an example of the way the president is using his position in the White House and in politics to enrich himself. We learn more about the president's businesses in recent days when he updated his financial disclosure form. The new report suggests the Trump properties that he frequently visits are seeing higher revenues. NPR senior business editor Marilyn Giewax heads a team of reporters who track the Trump family's business interests, and she joins us with the latest ethics news, a whole subcategory now. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Robin.
Start with that fundraiser at the Trump Hotel. What is happening there?
Well, this will be on Wednesday night. President Trump will be heading just down the street, just down Pennsylvania Avenue, to go from the White House to the Trump Hotel, where people will be paying as much as $100,000 each to see him. The money will go to the Trump Victory Fund. That's for big donors. And for small donors, there was an opportunity to pay as little as, say, $35 to make a donation. And then you're in a lottery. And if you won the lottery, your prize was, and President Trump said, it would be you'll get to stay at in D.C.'s finest hotel. Mm-hmm. So this event on Wednesday is unusual for two reasons. One is that presidents typically wait at least a good 2 years into their first term before they start that kind of fundraising. And then the second thing is that you're doing it, you know, he'll be doing it at his own property. And of course, there will be charges for food and drinks. So he's driving up his own revenues. And then also there's the publicity. He's going to have a whole room full of very well-heeled people who will be there, you know, lobbyists, business people. And they may get the hint that it pleases the president if you spend money at his hotel.
Well, we saw this sort of spending loop during the 2016 campaign. Trump he would take in donations, spend the money from the donations at his own properties. For instance, when he located his campaign headquarters in rented space inside Trump Tower.
Exactly. That's right. We've seen this before. The president would, when he was a candidate, would mm-hmm. raise money from donors, and then he paid it to himself, in effect, renting space at the Trump Tower for about $2 million. His campaign also charged $9 million for the use of his airplane. So this really gets weird mm-hmm. when you get to the hotel, because here's the really crazy part of it. The hotel is located inside of a historic building. It's the old post office building. That's owned by you and me, the taxpayers. Mm-hmm. This is a historic building. Inside of it is this hotel. So think about that. That's, the president is leasing the space, so he is a renter. But he's also in charge of appointing the person who can determine the rent. So he's the renter and the landlord. And he's also the customer because he's bringing this event to the hotel. So it's very strange set of circumstances that ethics experts say is really quite inappropriate.
Well, we're thinking, too, as you told us about what that lottery is going to be, he also gets to be the marketing executive because he says it's the best hotel in Washington, D.C.
But the finest.
This combination of roles, the president being the president and a promoter of Trump properties, appears to be, you know, working well for his businesses, according to the new financial disclosures.
Yes. Earlier this month, we got these financial disclosures, which Trump voluntarily put out. This disclosure was first put out in May of 2016 when it was required of him as a candidate. But, you know, he's never put out any tax statements. So this year, when spring came around, he refiled that financial disclosure statement. But, you know, it's really bare bones. It is not the tax filing. So this is just a statement of it's a 98-page laundry list of all the hundreds of business interests that he has in the countries all over the world where he has them. And it does provide you with a sense of what his conflicts of interest could be because it lists these assets. But, you know, it doesn't really show you a whole lot of detail, and it covered a somewhat different period of time from 2016. But what we did see in it, I mean, it seems pretty clear, is that the places that he goes to, like Mar-a-Lago and the hotel, have seen a surge in revenues. Mar-a-Lago's revenues were up considerably.
Well, and are we seeing the president get richer?
Now, the part about richer, that's a little more complicated because, as I say, this is a list of assets. This is what he has business interests in, but it doesn't tell you what his expenses are. So you see what the revenues are, but you don't see what he's spending. So is he really getting richer? We wouldn't know that unless he releases his tax returns, and he's made it pretty clear that he doesn't intend to do that. So, you know, and again, because it's a somewhat different set of months that the report's covered, it's not super precise, but it's better than nothing. It's the most we have.
Well, we can see from this report that he owes a lot of money, some $315 million to foreign and domestic lenders. And with past presidents, I'm thinking of President Obama, his ethics advisor didn't even want him to take out a mortgage.
That's right. Debt is something that ethics experts worry about a lot. They don't want you to be beholden to your lenders.
Yeah. Marilyn Geewax, senior business editor at NPR, heading a team of reporters who tracked the Trump family's business interests because this is an unusual presidency. Marilyn, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, Venezuela is in the midst of a terrible economic collapse. The country is in its third month of street protests against the socialist government of Nicolas Maduro. And many Venezuelan expats here in the U.S. are on a campaign to name and shame Venezuelan socialists living in enclaves like South Florida. Tim Padgett from Here and Now contributor WLRN in Miami reports.
On the night of May 12th, a group of Venezuelan expats gathered in front of the house of former Venezuelan Judge Dayva Soto in the South Florida suburb of Weston. They screamed insults at her in Spanish. "We'll force you out of Weston," they shouted in this video posted on YouTube. "You'll never be able to sleep here again." Most Venezuelan expats are bitter foes of Venezuela's socialist government. Soto had been identified on social media as the judge who sent Venezuelan opposition leader Leopoldo López to prison 3 years ago. So they considered Soto fair game for public shame and harassment. But there was just one really big problem. "Información falsa," Soto tells them. False information. Soto was a judge, but not the judge who jailed López. In fact, 13 years ago, she freed another jailed opposition leader, Enrique Capriles, when other judges wouldn't. And Capriles is now at the head of anti-government protests in Venezuela. After the May incident in Weston, he went on Twitter to praise Soto's courage. "Averigua," Dayva Soto says, "verify your information." But verify is something too few Venezuelan expats are doing in their rush to expose so-called enchufados. Enchufados are Venezuelan socialists, known as Chavistas, followers of the late President Hugo Chavez, who are now living wealthy lives in the U.S.
"The situation is like a witch hunt."
Levin de Gracia is co-owner of the Bocas restaurants in Doral, outside Miami. The city is the U.S.'s largest Venezuelan enclave. Last month, de Gracia was alarmed to see an anonymous Instagram post calling him an enchufado. It claimed de Gracia's business was laundering embezzled money for a Chavista official back in Venezuela. But the day the Instagram accusation posted, de Gracia was actually hosting an event condemning the Chavistas and collecting food and money for people struggling in Venezuela.
"There is no way for me to be an enchufado, but the news began to run around Doral, and it could break us. No Venezuelans want to go to a Chavista restaurant."
De Gracia quickly notified the FBI as well as local Spanish language media to make sure the slander that hit Diva Soto didn't clobber him. It's hard to fault expats for being furious at Venezuela's government. Their homeland's catastrophic economic misery is due largely to the authoritarian mismanagement of President Nicolás Maduro. And since April, more than 60 people have been killed in anti-government demonstrations there. So De Gracia understands the urge to call out people here who profited from corrupt socialist rule there.
But not if it hurts innocent people.
The witch-hunting information is created by both sides, by zealous government opponents and expats, but also Chavistas in Venezuela. The Chavistas do it to divide the exile community. De Gracia believes that's what happened to him. Either way, expats are often guilty of running with whatever they see on Instagram, Twitter, and WhatsApp. They use it to conduct escraches, public humiliations like the one in Weston.
Always, please identify where this information comes from. For me, it's one of the most important missions.
Benjamin De Jure is a Venezuelan expat journalist and a leader of the Democratic Party's Hispanic Caucus in Miami-Dade County. He's made it his mission to trawl social media for dangerously false Venezuela-related posts and warn expats here about them. De Jure, whose columns often run in Miami's largest Spanish-language daily, El Nuevo Herald, says he's also concerned about the integrity of Venezuela's opposition, especially the exile community, which wants U.S. politicians to back its anti-Chavista cause.
You publish things that are not true, the credibility of the people here is destroyed. You know, and the regime is going to last more.
There are, of course, cases where the Enchufado information is true. Like this recent incident, also posted on YouTube. Expats in a Miami restaurant are hounding a former Chavista finance minister who now lives in Florida. They eventually drive him out the door. But De Jure says people should avoid vigilantism and instead tell authorities, who can then determine if enchufados and their money are here illegally. Otherwise, expats risk looking guilty of witch-hunting political opponents, precisely what they accused the Chavistas of doing back in Venezuela. For Here and Now, I'm Tim Padgett in Miami.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Sunbasket. Sunbasket makes it easy to cook nutritionist-approved meals in your own kitchen with organic, non-GMO ingredients from farms and fishermen sent directly to your door. Choose from paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and family options. You'll get pre-measured ingredients and easy-to-follow directions and get dinner on the table in 30 minutes. It's healthy cooking designed to fit your busy lifestyle, and it's delicious. Here and Now listeners get their first three meals free at sunbasket.com/now.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is trying to wrangle the votes he needs to pass the Senate Republican health care bill by the end of the week. But Republican conservatives like Rand Paul want costs slashed even further. Moderates like Dean Heller of Nevada say the cuts are too much, particularly in Medicaid. Now, you'll remember Obamacare expanded Medicaid coverage beyond poor children, the disabled, and the poor elderly to include poor able-bodied adults. It's expected the Republican plan will roll that expansion back. Here's Heller's reaction on Friday.
On Medicaid expansion, probably half of the dollars that were spent on that was on mental health and opioid abuse. And the fact that we think we can pull the rug out from under that expansion and those dollars for that insurance is a big concern of mine.
Now, Medicaid is run by the states, but largely funded by the federal government. And Heller also blasted proposals to roll back those federal Medicaid reimbursements. Right now, states are pretty much reimbursed for every dollar spent. In the Senate Republican plan, that would be capped. Counselor to the president, Kellyanne Conway, defended the plan to ABC's George Stephanopoulos.
These are not cuts to Medicaid, George. This slows the rate for the future, and it allows governors more flexibility with Medicaid dollars because they're closest to the people in need. Medicaid's imperative.
In fact, 72 million Americans rely on the program, which began 52 years ago under President Johnson. We'll be hearing different views this week, but let's start today with Matt Salo, the executive director of the National Association of Medicaid Directors, which, Matt, means what? Who's in your association?
So we represent the 56 people across the country who actually run the Medicaid program. And as you know, Medicaid is the largest health insurance program in the country, and it tends to consume about 25% to 30% of the average state budget.
Okay, so you have people like Senator Heller and others saying that the new plan from Republicans will mean cuts to Medicaid, cuts to the expansion, for instance, and you have Kellyanne Conway there saying there are not cuts. What's true in your opinion?
I think there very clearly are cuts. You're talking about taking hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars away from this program, a program that is already very lean, very efficient, very effective. And I think it's also important to keep in mind there are two things going on in this debate, one of which is a rollback of the expansion that was a part of Obamacare, but the other is something that is completely unrelated to the Affordable Care Act at all, and that's converting the Medicaid program to a per capita cap.
We'll talk a little bit about that. And first of all, your claim that the program is already very lean, most researchers agree with that. But, you know, there is a sense that there's a lot of fraud in Medicaid, abuse of Medicaid. So are you saying that you and the Medicaid directors don't see that?
There is no more fraud or abuse or waste or inefficiency in Medicaid than there is in Medicare or than there is in private coverage. It is an effective, efficient, high-quality program.
Well, go to the two cuts then that you mentioned or what you and others are perceiving as cuts. First of all, this rollback of the expansion. The expansion was expanding Medicaid to able-bodied adults who were poor. This is mostly young men, as it turns out. There are a lot of people who feel they should not be on Medicaid. They should be going out and getting a job. But talk about the rollback of the expansion. Why should not that happen?
I think what you're seeing in the expansion and what we've heard from Senator Heller is what we've heard from governors across the country, which is saying when you look at the data, when you look at the numbers of who we're covering and what we're spending in the expansion, it's a really, really large amount of money spent on mental health and substance abuse. And there's no question that the Medicaid expansion has been the tip of the spear that many states have used to try to confront the opioid crisis in this country. Yeah. And so what you would be doing is, as you are starting to stabilize individuals who have mental health or substance abuse issues or both, you'd be pulling the rug out from underneath them. And that is going to be highly problematic. That is not going to help these individuals get a job.
And we're seeing reports that many of the states that did take the Medicaid expansion did so on the condition that they would rescind that coverage for new enrollees. So these able-bodied childless adults in Arkansas, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, New Hampshire, New Mexico, Washington would lose coverage if the Senate bill were to pass and the rollback were to happen. Talk about the change in reimbursement from pretty much a dollar-to-dollar matching amount to the cap. The Senate backers of that plan say it's going to save $800 billion. What's wrong with it?
What's wrong with this is that Medicaid directors on a bipartisan basis have been calling for years for reforms, for changes to help us better manage the program. But that's not what this is. This is simply saying this partnership, this state and federal financial partnership that has existed for 50 years is going to be unilaterally revoked, and that the federal government would essentially wash their hands of the responsibility if costs started to rise beyond a certain level.
Right.
And I think the problem there is that, you know, Medicaid is and healthcare is predictably unpredictable. There are spikes in costs when we have things like a new treatment for hepatitis C. Medicaid has been used to address catastrophes like Hurricane Katrina, the Flint water crisis. And when one side of that partnership walks away from that commitment, you're really talking about the greatest intergovernmental transfer of financial risk in our country's history.
You mean from the federal government to the states?
That's right.
Well, and, you know, states would have to decide who to cut. But you said something fascinating in there, that this is not a consistent payout, that when there is, for instance, hepatitis C, which there recently was a vaccine for that, it spiked. The payments spiked.
That's absolutely right. Costs will spike as the underlying drivers of health care go up. This is unworkable. This is unsustainable. This is going to be billions and billions of dollars cut out of the program, and that will have very, very real human repercussions.
What do you say to people who say that's scare tactics? You know, people have said that state officials might have to decide to raise taxes or reduce payments to nursing homes. We've heard talk of, you know, eliminate benefits like home-based care for disabled beneficiaries. All of that now covered.
Oh, no, I don't think those are scare tactics at all. Those are very, very real. Governor Ducey of Arizona, very, very conservative Republican, he tells this story. He points out that Arizona was the first all-red state, Republican governor, Republican House, Republican Senate, to do the Medicaid expansion under Obamacare. And the part of the rationale he gives is that Arizona used to have, you know, pre-ACA, relatively generous coverage. But then when the recession hit, the state found itself, you know, without enough money to maintain Medicaid coverage at that level.
And one of the worst housing crises in the country.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. They ended up having to roll back coverage in a way that is eerily reminiscent of what would happen under this bill. And what the governor says is that put us in the position of sitting across the table from a 55-year-old man who had just gotten coverage, just gotten successful treatment for cancer, and is in the midst of that treatment, and we had to say, sorry, you're done. No more coverage for you. There's nothing you can do about that. He has communicated this to the congressional leaders. If you put us in the position of having to do that again, and again, keep in mind there's at least 17 Republican governors in states who have done the expansion, he said, you will put us in the political minority for the next generation. So when there isn't enough money to go around, you're going to have to look at, you know, where do you spend your money? And when you look at Medicaid, and I think this is really, really important, 2/3 of the Medicaid program is spent on seniors, people with disabilities, and long-term care. That's where the money is. And if you're taking hundreds of billions of dollars out of it, that's where you're going to have to go to find the savings. States are just not going to raise taxes in order to cover $800 billion in cuts. And anyone who thinks that's going to happen has been ignoring the dynamics, the political and fiscal dynamics in state capitals for the past decade. That's not going to happen.
Well, you mentioned the cuts that might happen. Probably those will happen before the cuts to the 76% of all poor children in the United States who are covered by Medicaid, the 60% of all children with disabilities. Matt Salo, the executive director of the National Association of Medicaid Directors, thank you.
Thank you.
The United Nations says 300,000 people in Yemen could be infected with cholera in the coming weeks. The outbreak has already killed about 1,000 people since it began in April, and the ongoing civil war has made matters worse. Doctors aren't getting paid, hospitals are closed or destroyed. And in Yemen, it's already difficult to be a doctor or a scientist, especially if you're a woman. NPR's Michaeline Duclef has this profile of a scientist who was forced to flee.
2 years ago, Iqbal Khan was going to work in the morning as usual. She's a biochemistry professor at a university where she studies the nutrition of food. She was driving on the freeway when suddenly...
I feel something on my car, but I ignore because I was driving very fast.
Something had smacked into the side of her car, hard. She reached the parking lot, got out of the car and looked at the door. What she saw left her speechless.
I got gun in my car, just on the door.
A bullet went through your door?
Yeah.
Right next to you?
Yes.
Iqbal was okay. The door had stopped the bullet. She has no idea where it came from, but it turned out to be an ominous sign of what was to come. You see, Iqbal is a woman scientist in one of the hardest places on Earth just to be a woman. Yemen. The World Economic Forum ranks Yemen as the worst country for women's rights. Women have such few rights that many can't leave their homes without permission from their husbands.
If she go out with her brother, husband, it's okay.
But not on her own.
This is our culture.
A culture where the majority of women can't read, half are married by age 18, some as young as age 8. And then there's the black veil. Many women in Yemen, including Iqbal, cover their entire face with a black veil, except for a small slit across their eyes.
I cover my face because I respect our culture.
Respect, yes. Blindly follow, no. For the past decade, Iqbal has busted through glass ceiling after glass ceiling with grace and fearlessness. Even as a young girl, Ekbal says she was a rebel.
I was very naughty.
You were naughty?
Yeah.
She liked breaking rules and proving people wrong. So when her parents told her she might not have the smarts to go into science and engineering like her dad, Ekbal thought, of course I can.
I told my father, I heard a lot about scientists in chemistry. What's the difference between me and them? So I want to try.
And she did more than try. She crushed it. Ekbal won over her father, got his financial support, and was the first among her friends to finish college. Then she got a scholarship to do her PhD in Malaysia. That led to her writing a book about the fruits mentioned in the Quran and their health benefits, and people love it.
Very successful book now.
Very successful book.
Ekbal became such a big star in the Middle East that Al Sayed University in Yemen made her an assistant professor and head of a medical department, all before age 35. Ekbal was on top of the world. Then one morning, it was all taken away. In March 2015, Ekbal's hometown of Taiz got tangled up in Yemen's bloody civil war. That's tape taken from Euro News. Bombs were exploding everywhere.
They bombing the university.
They were bombing the university.
Yeah, they killed some of my students. It's very bad. It's very bad. I show you.
She turns to her computer and brings up some photos.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. Yeah, very bad.
On the screen is a photo of several bodies lying flat on the ground, lined up next to each other, covered in cream white sheets.
This is, 9 persons from my family.
You lost 9 family members.
Yes. They bombing their house. They die all. 9 persons from my family.
Are these some children in your family?
Yes.
A few of the bodies are small. Ekbal's niece, nephew.
Sorry.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
That's why I left my country.
After the bombing, Ekbal spent a few months trapped in Yemen. Trapped in a city where snipers shoot children. Bombs fall on mosques, schools, markets.
They bombing everywhere, randomly.
And then one day, she had an idea. Maybe her science could get her out of the war. She started texting her mentor in Malaysia, applied for a special refugee fellowship, and a month later, she was safe on a plane headed for Kuala Lumpur. Now she's working to save up money so she can get her parents and sister out of the war.
I want to bring my family, but it's very difficult.
But Ekbal persists. She works long hours in lab, continues to publish papers, teach students, and has never lost sight of her big dreams.
I have to be strong, strong. I want to be strong.
And what is your dream, the ultimate dream?
My dream, Nobel Prize.
Nobel Prize.
But I don't think so. It's very difficult.
I don't know. I wouldn't bet against you.
And Ekbal has already done so much for science. Because when little girls in the Middle East see photos of Ekbal as a chemist, wearing a headscarf while pipetting and measuring pH, they don't need to use their imagination to think, I could be just like her. I could be a scientist. Michaeline Duclef, NPR News.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.